I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. This episode contains explicit language. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people, and we are coming to you live from the Miracle Theater in Washington, D.C. All right, here we go. This is the second half of my conversation with Chef Kwame Onwuachi of the D.C. restaurant Kith & Kin, which we're repeating with an all-new update this week in honor of our 10th anniversary. That update is at the end of this episode. Now, if you haven't heard part one yet, please go back. You really should hear Kwame's story in order. When we left off, it was 11 years ago. He was cooking on a boat somewhere in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. That's where he got his first clue that he wanted to be a chef. From there, Kwame moved to New York to start a catering company. He was still just 20 years old, didn't have a ton of experience. But as we learned in part one, Kwame can hustle.
So yeah, I was in a store in Soho, and I started striking up a conversation with the cashier. She happened to be the owner of the store, and they opened like last week. And she was like, I'm really excited. I'm throwing this like opening party. Like, you seem like cool. Do you want to come? I was like, yeah, I'll come. That's all. You like, so you're excited about it? Like, you got everything? You're ready for this party? She's like, yeah, I'm ready. So if only I had a caterer. I'm just like, you know, I really want to do this like mini cheesecakes. And I was like, you never asked me what I do. And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, I'm a caterer. And she's like, you're a caterer? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a caterer. She's like, how old are you? I was like, ma'am, that is irrelevant. You know? What catering services do you need? Clearly are in dire need of help, so I'll see what I can do. And she was like, well, like I said, I want to make these mini cheesecakes. Can you make cheesecakes? And I was like, please don't just... I just told you I was a chef and a caterer. I'll be here tomorrow with cheesecakes. And I went home, and I've never made cheesecakes before in my life. So if any of you know that when you make a cheesecake, it's a process. Like, you have to, you know, make the cheesecake. You have to let it set. You have to let it cool. Then you have to cut into it to find out if it's good. So
you don't know for 3 hours whether or not it's good.
No. Mm-mm. I didn't know that leading up to this. So I get home, and I call my sister because she always used to make the baked goods for, like, my mom's catering company. I'm like, okay, how do I make a cheesecake? She's like, you just take the eggs, the cream cheese, you know, a little vanilla, lemon juice, sugar, and you whip that together, you know, maybe some milk, and, you know, you pour it in your crust, and you bake it off. I'm like, easy. How hard can this be? So I add it together. It's a little lumpy because I didn't, like, you know, warm or, like, let the cream cheese cool down, but I'm like, it's gonna heat up and like come together anyway, right? So do that. 3 hours later, cut into it, it's just like, you know, big globs of like cream cheese in there. I'm like, fuck, all right, I got time. All right, the second one is good. How do I, you need to walk this through me step by step.
You're back, Tatiana, on the phone with your sister.
Yeah, right. She's like, did you heat the cream cheese? I'm like, no, because you didn't tell me to heat the cream cheese. She's like, all right, heat the cream cheese, whip the eggs in, add your vanilla, add your sugar, a little bit of milk, put it in the crust, bake it off, set it, cut into it, it'll be perfect. So I heat the cream cheese, I add the eggs to it, and like as soon as it hits, it kind of, it like turns the scrambled eggs a little bit, but I'm like, once it heats, it'll like come together. I'm trying to convince myself that this is like science. you know what happens. I cut into it 3 hours later. It's fucking scrambled eggs and the cheesecake. I'm like, Tatiana, if you do not give me these explicit, it is 3 a.m. I got to be at this thing at 9 a.m. So, yeah, she tells me, you know, don't heat it up too much. It's an emulsification. You got to emulsify the eggs into the cream cheese, add the vanilla, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of milk. Do it. Boom. 3 hours later, it's beautiful cheesecake. And it is 6 a.m. And I just realized at that time, like, man, I didn't do, like, I was so focused on making this cheesecake perfect. I wasn't on my phone. I wasn't really listening to music. I wasn't watching anything. I just was, like, really trying to focus on making this cheesecake. I must really love this. And I need to really put everything into this because I've never done anything like this in my entire life and sat still for anything. And then that's the moment I found out I should be cooking for the rest of my life.
So you decide you're going to go to the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America.
Yeah.
But you need money for that. That's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So you sell some candy on the subway. You made $20,000 selling candy on the subway?
Yeah. Sold a lot of candy.
People ought to hitch their wagon to you wherever you're going, Kwame. But you also asked each of your respective parents to help pay for the, for tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
My mom gave me her last money. She had like $2,000 saved up and she was like, this is for your future. You know, this is for your future children, your future family. And you have an opportunity to have a life that I didn't have. And, you know, that meant the world to me that she did that. Cause I knew her money had a real sum. There were real hours for her money, you know, like every $20 was an hour, you know, at work. And that money saved up was everything that she had. My father, on the other hand,
and I should say, like, your father was kind of in your life, but split up from your mom.
Yeah,
not nearly as much in your life as your mom was, but he was around.
He was there. You right, know, he wasn't an absentee father or anything.
Right.
He was just, we didn't really get along, so we didn't hang out. You know, and that was that. That was it.
But you asked him.
I asked him for money, and he suggested that I go back to dealing drugs to get through school. It wasn't a horrible idea. I was making good money, but it's not the path that I wanted to go back into, you know. It was a strange thing coming from my father, too,
right,
to be honest.
So
he told me he can get me drugs, too. I'm like, who do you know? Like,
But that was also, I gather from the book, that was kind of a breaking point with your father.
Yeah, that's when I knew I needed to, like, separate myself from that situation, you know. And, you know, there's no blueprint on being a parent. You know, I don't know if he was trying to be cool, but it just was something that I didn't need. I didn't need that negativity or someone trying to steer me off the path that I was going on.
Coming up, Kwame goes to culinary school. Then later, he opens his first restaurant, and things go very, very wrong. Stick around.
It's time to open up a can of advertisements.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants: Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature al fresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. Recently, I went into my closet to try to get a collared shirt out, and it occurred to me that I don't think I have bought a new collared shirt in 5 years. I mean, every shirt in there was either really old, or it had some kind of perma-stain situation, or it probably never fit right in the first place. I gotta freshen up a little bit here. It's time for something new, right? And spring is coming. Now is the time if you've been looking to refresh your wardrobe, home, or skincare and beauty routines this season. Because, you know, Walmart has genuinely surprising style finds that don't break the bank. This spring, there's only one destination for the latest fashion, home, and beauty inspired by real life. Walmart. I freshened up my wardrobe. I got some nice dress shirts, a couple light hoodies. You know, you need light hoodies for the springtime. Very useful, very comfortable. Discover surprisingly stylish new season favorites at Walmart now, or shop it all on the Walmart app. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending. Now trending, your style at Walmart. I continue to get a lot of flack for my PB&J technique, okay? Jelly on the top, jelly on the bottom, peanut butter in the middle. That's the way to go. And the first thing people say is, well, when you spread the jelly on both sides and then spread the peanut butter on top, you're going to tear the bread. And my answer to you is, use better bread. Like Hero Bread. You get that whole wheat Hero Bread. It's got some grain. It's got some heft. It's got some flavor. It's got some texture. And it will stand up to my excellent PB&J technique. Hero makes delicious breads that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, but plenty of protein and fiber. The soft, fluffy experience you love when enjoying a refreshing BLT, a savory breakfast burrito, or a mouthwatering cheeseburger, you can have all that with Hero Breads. And let me tell you, we are a big burrito-eating family in our house. Breakfast burritos happen multiple times a week, and these Hero Flour tortillas are perfect for it. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co, that's hero.co, and use code Sporkful at checkout for that discount. That's code Sporkful at hero.co. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know that peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. If you're new to our show and want to check out some of our coverage of race and food, I have two episodes to recommend to you. One is about the use of the word plantation in food branding. You'll see a recipe for a plantation chicken or a tea called plantation mint. And that word doesn't tell you anything about the specific ingredients or preparation. So what are white people in food trying to say when they use it? We explore, and things get uncomfortable.
You know, I really don't enjoy this conversation. I did not come into it thinking that this was going to be turning me into an apologist for slavery.
That episode is called When White People Say Plantation. We've also done two episodes that delve into issues of systemic racism at Bon Appetit, including one with former Test Kitchen star Sola El Whaley.
I always grew up believing that I would always experience casual racism, and that's just a fact of life, and that there's no way around it. But I finally think that, like, maybe we don't have to anymore.
Those episodes all came out back in June, July, and August, so scroll through our feed to find them. And please subscribe to or follow our podcast while you're doing that. Thanks. Now back to my conversation with Kwame Nwachi. So he graduates from the Culinary Institute of America at age 24, and starts working at some of the top restaurants in New York. 11 Madison Park, Per Se, these are Michelin star places, super fancy. But for the chefs at the bottom of the kitchen hierarchy, it could be brutal.
Just the work in general was really, really tough. It wasn't something that I was like prepared for. I didn't know it was going to be that intense. Because I've been cooking since such a young age, when I did go and work in kitchens, I was usually like the fastest person, and like, you know, my stuff just like tasted better. I don't know. I just cared about what I was doing. And most kitchens, there's like that one person that really, really cares about every single detail. But in these kitchens, every single person cares about every single detail.
Right. It's like getting into Harvard when you were like first in your class in high school, but now everyone's first in their class.
Right. So it's like, you're not shit. You know, you have to start at the bottom and you have to work your way up. So it was really difficult. The thing that I wasn't prepared for was like the racism that comes with, that can be hidden behind like the veil of this like bravado of like being a chef and like yelling at everyone, and you know, but you can mask a lot of stuff. Now you can mask like sexism, you can mask racism, you can mask xenophobia, you can mask a lot of things behind that hazing mentality.
Is there a specific moment that you can think of that illustrates
that? The first one, yeah, I remember there was just one guy that was just such a fucking asshole to me. And it was like, I was a commis. So I was like the bottom of the bottom. Like we weren't even allowed to sit at our menu meetings. Like we had to stand around and just take notes of what everyone was saying. And I was fine with that. Like everyone was doing it. But like at nighttime, they would use us for a lot of stuff on the fly, meaning like get them things like right away. If they ran out of, I don't know, peeled walnuts, which is like a horrible thing to do. It's like
that sounds like impossible. Like, is it physically hard. Possible to it's, peel a walnut?
When they first tell you to do it, it feels like it's impossible. But you know, after your 10th one in 6 hours, you realize that it is possible. It just takes a long fucking time. So when
like
they
that
run
seems like
out
something
of,
that was invented specifically to torture young chefs.
Yeah, I think so. So after you know they ran out of them, they're like, hey, you know. Most of the time, they're like, hey, man, like, come here. Like, can you go and peel these for me? You know, but this one guy was, like, really such an, like, very pointed and, like, sharp to me. And I noticed there was a difference between the other commis and when he would say it. And, you know, with that, I just wanted to prove him wrong. So I would do it faster and do it better and bring it to him. And whenever I brought it to him, he would snatch it from me or be like, get the fuck out of here after he got it from me and things like that. And I remember being in the locker room. And I was talking to one of the other commis. I was like, man, what's wrong with this guy? Like, you seem to be cool with him. He was like, yeah, he'll never be cool with you, man. And I was like, what do you mean? And I was like, he's like, when you got here, he said some things. I don't really want to repeat it. And I'm like, what do you mean? What did he say? I'm still like, I'm not thinking it has to do with race. I'm just like, what do you mean? Like, what did he say? I can take it. I have a big nose. I understand. You know, like, I thought it was something about my appearance or something. And he was like, No. He was like, oh, here comes another black guy that's going to be super lazy here. And I was like, what? You know, and that was like the first polarizing moment for me in fine dining. And then I still had to answer to him and work through it because if you speak up, it's like a death sentence.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that I learned from your book is that incredibly regimented fine dining kitchen style, which, as you say, often also lends itself to all kinds of abuse, mm-hmm. was actually created by like a French military guy like that. So like it is yeah, very military in system. Nature.
Yeah.
And including the part like in all the movies where the sergeant screams at the new recruits and mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Kind of break you down to build you up mentality.
I heard you interviewed another podcast and you were talking about those early days in fine dining and you talked about that there's this mentality in those kitchens of working people this is your quote now, working people to death, abusing people physically or verbally. And for me, I know it brought back a lot of psychological issues that I faced as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I went through a lot as a kid and it brought me back into that space as being a child, being very vulnerable, of being continuously broken down and not seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I'm just seeing this fucking peeled walnut at the end of the plate, you know, that took me forever to make. And there's no gratitude in it. And that brought me back to my childhood of that abuse, of that, you know, that verbal abuse. And it was tough to thrive in that environment.
Verbal abuse, you're talking about like mostly your father.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hell of a commentary on these fine dining kitchens that growing up with an abusive father is like the best preparation.
Yeah. I had a thick skin in there for sure. I was able to take it. And those are the people that really thrive in those environments. Are the people that just put their head down and say, yes, chef, and like brush a lot of these things off. But the people that break, you know, the people that put in their notice because they can't take it anymore or just never show back up. Those are the people that I think we're really losing out on in this industry. Some people haven't had that conditioning of going through shit that I went through as a child, you know? Or certain people can't like brush off the guy that's, you know, profiling you as soon as you walk through the door, but still relying on you to get some mise en place to them. And I think that's where our industry is really losing is we're just losing people for so many reasons that we are in control of.
Absolutely. So after a period of fine dining, you start looking to open your own place. You're a lot of the people who want to invest in you think that you should do upscale soul food. They're kind of pigeonholing you. You get on Top Chef, although your restaurant was already in the works before that. But you know, although you didn't win, you were kind of a fan favorite. And then you get these investors who finally say, "What do you want to do?" And you say, "I'm going to open this restaurant, Shaw Bijou." Your mom's name was Jewel, so Bijou, French for jewelry, in Shaw neighborhood in D.C. And so, and that's kind of based on your life story. But just before opening, the investors basically tell you that they're running out of money and you have to charge $180 a person, which was much more than you wanted to charge.
Yeah.
And when that news gets out in the D.C. foodie media, what's the reaction?
It wasn't good. It wasn't good at all.
Right. People were pissed.
People were upset.
And they were pissed. And then, you know, the restaurant opened after 2 years of preparation and $2 million and then closed in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And people were really pissed about how much you were charging. And then when the restaurant closed, even in New York, I remember sensing a disproportionate level of glee.
It's a good way to put it. Yeah, like.
Where do you think that? I mean, look, $180 is a lot of money, but there was an especially strong reaction.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was hate, like hate in the heart that needed to be let out.
But I mean, like it seemed like people were kind of saying, like, who does this guy think he is?
Yeah.
And yet you had trained quite a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think about it all the time, you know, why people were so upset. You know, because you just didn't have to go there if you didn't want to, you know, eat the food. These are things I think about in the shower sometimes. I'm just like, you didn't want to eat. You didn't have to, like, go there, you know? Or was it because I was black and young? Did I not have enough tattoos? You know, I'm just, like, thinking of, like, weird things. I don't know. I can't put my finger on it.
So, was there ever a time where you, like, it seems like from that time on the boat when you were in the Gulf of Mexico and you're like, this is what I should be doing with my life. Or then, you know, you're cooking the cheesecake and you say, you realize how focused you are. This is what I should be doing with my life. I mean, after Shaw Bijou closed, obviously you questioned some things about your approach, but did you ever question that?
Yeah, I question if I should still be cooking, you know, if I'm as good as I think I am. Unfortunately, you start to really believe what people are saying about you, you know, especially when you're defeated and they're still kicking you while you're down. You know, there were so many articles on why the Shaw Bijou closed and what I could have done better. And I'm reading these things like, maybe they're right, you know? And I think for me, having a group of people around me that believed in me more than I believed in myself, you know, people that were still with me from that catering company I started when I didn't even know how to make a cheesecake, you know, but still believed in me. That's what really got me back on my feet. And I opened, you know, I haven't really told anybody about this, but I opened a restaurant like a month and a half later.
Opened Kith and Kin?
No, a restaurant that I've just not talked about. I just wanted to cook again without the press, without like talking to people, without going into the dining room. I just wanted to cook. You know, I know I couldn't just go and get a line cook job. So I just opened a restaurant. My friend acted as the chef and the press and the owner. And I just cooked. And it was great.
This was between Shaw Bijou and Kith and Kin.
Yeah.
What was it called?
I can't tell you that.
Is it still open?
I can't tell you that.
Come on, Kwame. I mean, there's a lot of restaurants in this city. That's not exactly going to give it away.
You seem like you talk to a lot of people. I don't know if what you're going to get out of me.
So I'll take that as a yes, that it's still open. Somewhere in the city, there's a restaurant, a secret Kwame Onwuachi restaurant. It's kind of cool. I think you should like open a secret restaurant in other cities.
No, it was great. It was fun. I had fun doing it, yeah. But I wanted to cook again. I wanted to get my passion back without like having to deal with anything. Just cook, you know? And I did that for, I think, 3 months. And then the Intercontinental called me. They Facebook messaged me. They didn't call me. Slid in my DMs.
Right.
Yeah. You know what's funny? It's a funny story. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in this like Netflix wormhole of like Black Mirror, and like I remember I was like in my room with like my hoodie on. It's like this, like
very bundled up.
Very bundled.
Hoodie, just,
like,
blanket.
Watching Black Mirror, like that's crazy. What if this happens, you know? And and then like the little message thing comes on, like the Facebook. I don't know the sound that it made. It was like something like that. And I clicked on it and it was like, you have a message. I'm like, okay, cool. So I open it up. And it was a guy named Mufasa. And there's two things about like Mufasa. Like, first off, I don't know anyone named Mufasa. And more importantly, I don't know any white people named Mufasa. And there was a white guy in the circle thing. And I'm like, who is fucking with me? Once again, DC, leave me alone. And it's like, want to open a restaurant? I'm like, you got to do better. X, like, go back to Black Mirror and watching this. So like a month goes by and finally I'm like, all right, let me just, I'm like, hey, you know, like I just respond back like, hey.
Right.
And he's like, oh my God, we've been waiting for you to respond to us. Like, we just got this space on the water. Can you come in for an interview? We want you to do whatever you want. And I was like, okay. So I came and it was a fucking white guy named Mufasa. It was crazy. So I'm like, this is a sign. I should be doing this. This is crazy. And he's like, let me take you to the waterfront, to the wharf. And I'm like, what's the wharf? He's like, this new development that we working on for like 10 years. So we go there and it's like just a shell and it's overlooking the water. And he's like, this is your restaurant if you want it. And I'm like, why are you doing this? And he's like, we had people that came to the Strawberry Jew. They said it was fucking awesome. So if you want it, it's yours. You don't have a job, do you? You know? And I was like, yeah. Besides my secret restaurant, I think I'll do this.
Right. So, what are you thinking? I mean, you're in this like empty shell of a restaurant in this empty development that is now like, I mean, now I think every city kind of has their industrial area that's been transformed into like an upscale hipster enclave. Mm-hmm. I think that the DC one is especially nice. Some of the other cities, I feel like they're a little soulless, but I love the one, the DC area, I think is beautiful. But it wasn't beautiful then. It was still empty.
Yeah, it was empty.
And they're just like, here, like we're Intercontinental Hotels. It's like a massive international hotel chain. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we just want to give this to you. Like a month ago, you were watching Black Mirror in your hoodie. Like, what are you thinking?
I still had the hoodie on, by the way. just with a hard hat. There was a lot of things. I was scared because I was like, how big is this restaurant? They were like, I don't know, like 7,000 square feet. You know, I'm like, okay, that sounds big. I was like, how many seats? They're like, probably like 200 seats. I'm like, okay, shit. I was like, so like, you got somebody to do like room service? They're like, no, we don't. That'd be you. And I was like, all right, fuck. I was like, so we're only open for dinner, right? They're like, no, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like, okay, Kwame, all right. All right, where do I sign? You know, that was just like that. I was nervous for a second, but I'm like, you know, I only have one life to live, so why not go for it?
And so the menu for folks who haven't been is Afro-Caribbean at its essence. Is that mm-hmm. fair to say?
Yeah. So the restaurant Kith and Kin is split into two. It's like there's Kith and there's Kin. So Kith means friends. So that's more of my friendly interpretations of dishes. That's what you'll see, like the cucumber avocado salad with gooseberry piri piri or uni escovitch, right? And then on the Kin is family. It's dishes that I don't really mess with. Like, these are my family dishes. If I made a jerk chicken roulade, my grandmother would slap the shit out of me, you know? So, like, I make good jerk chicken, but we think about it a little bit more, I think.
I want to ask you about the word elevate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a word that gets thrown around in food a lot. And to me, it sort of often has a certain code in it because often the cuisine that is being elevated, when we're told that a chef is elevating some cuisine, the cuisine being elevated is a cuisine associated with brown or black people. And the way that it's being elevated is by applying European techniques and sensibilities. So that use of that word, you know, assumes a certain hierarchy in food. What do you make of that word?
I think it's like you can look at it in different ways, because if you do go to France, there is French country food, like countryside food, you know, and that's not as elevated as food in Paris. They have their country style pâtés in Paris. They do, you know, really nice foie gras torchons. So it's like, you know, I don't want to say that like if I'm elevating a dish that is African or Caribbean descent, it's, and I'm using some techniques that they don't even have to be European. It could just be I'm being just a little bit more thoughtful in the techniques that I have learned. If I'm going to make a puree, I'm going to make it the smoothest and creamiest puree, and it may not be as chunky. Is that wrong to say that I elevated it in that aspect? I don't think so, you know? But when you say something isn't elegant, I think that can be some sort of marginalization to a certain group of food, because I think jerk chicken is very elegant. So like I brine the chicken in like a jerk brine for 2 days. We make our own jerk paste. We import wood from Jamaica, pimento wood to smoke it. And, you know, our coconut milk we make in-house and we toast it for the rice and peas. So we braise the cabbage in red stripe and ginger garlic puree and then baste it with butter. So like we put thought into it. But if you go to like your auntie's house, like she will put thought in her food. So I wouldn't say that I'm like extremely elevating that stuff. I'm just doing it as if like a really good cook in Jamaica or Nigeria were made to make it. That's how it would come out.
And in terms of running the kitchen behind the scenes, Kith and Kinem, I know you sort of have said earlier that you had to sort of learn to be more compassionate, forget some of the old habits that you brought with you from some of those fancy restaurant kitchens and the way that those places are run. Is that ever a struggle?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
How so?
All the time. Because you're just used to like, it's like a baby mentality. Like you yell, you get your way, you know? And it's like trying to like stop that is difficult. And I'm still learning that.
So your book opens with the scene where you are cooking the food for the opening of the National African American History and Culture Museum. I hope I got the order of those words right. But the museum in, here in D.C., you're cooking for the opening and you kind of are in your chef's whites overlooking the scene, preparing for the meal. And I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt from the book where you're setting that scene. Sure. Here you go.
Take a sip of water. I don't think this is the right page. Joining me tonight is a chef who has become well-known, not just for...
Plug in. I slipped a Sporkful plug into your book. I don't know if you knew about that.
There are two of me. Well, more than two, but two have starring roles for the night. Chef Kwame and Kwame All Smiles. Both are me, but not all of me. As any artist with patrons know, there's a song and dance to be done for the guests. Luckily for me, I've spent my life modulating which Kwame to show to the world. There was Kwame of his father's house and Kwame of his mother's kitchen. Kwame at school and Kwame in Nigeria. Kwame the drug kingpin and Kwame on television. The only Kwame I haven't yet settled on is Kwame alone, with no one else watching. I'm still trying to figure out who that one is.
So I want to do like a little... I want to tick back through all those Kwames, and I want you to sort of tell me the couple of words to describe each one. Who's Chef Kwame?
Serious, determined, filled with passion.
Kwame All Smiles.
Jokester, pensive, and... thoughtful.
Kwame of his father's house.
Insecure, melancholy, and scared.
Kwame of his mother's kitchen.
Confident, happy, experimental.
Kwame at school.
Bored. Hi.
Kwame in Nigeria.
I would say inventive. This is hard. exploring. Yeah.
Kwame the drug kingpin.
Rich.
Kwame on television.
Nervous.
What about Kwame alone? This book was written now 2 years ago, and you say the one I haven't settled on yet is Kwame alone with no one else watching. So have you figured out who Kwame alone is?
No, I'm still figuring that out. I think everyone is figuring that out. You know, we're around people more than we are by ourselves. So it's self-exploration that I don't think really ends until, like, you're old and you don't really care what you say in front of people. And you're just like, I think about like my grandmother and my grandfather, or they'll just like tell you exactly how they feel. So I think it takes time to get to that point.
Yeah. My wife and I are in our early 40s, and she was remarking recently, Janie was saying that she's like, man, now that I'm in my 40s, I just sort of like tell, she was talking to a friend of hers who's in her 50s. And Janie says, now that I'm in my 40s, I just tell people what I think and I don't really care. And her friend said, wait till you get to your 50s.
I'll wait. Just wait for that.
All right, his memoir is called Notes from a Young Black Chef. Big hand for Kwame Onwuachi.
Thank you.
And a big hand for all of you. Thank you so much for coming out. Good night. Kwame.
Dan, what's up, man?
I don't have your video on now, but I assume that you have a nutcracker in hand, I hope.
That's why I got my video off. So I can drink two at once and not be judged by you or anyone else.
For the record, I would not judge you for double-fisting nutcrackers.
At least out loud, you wouldn't. I'd give you that.
I follow Kwame on Instagram, so I know that he's been staying very busy during this pandemic. Seems like every week he's repping a new brand like San Pellegrino or Sweetgreen. He's even developing recipes for a baby food company. He's doing a take on Caribbean rice and peas and curried squash, but as a puree. And did you test pilot the recipes on babies?
I tested it on myself, which is very similar to a baby. and then they did actual market research and gave it to infants. I mean, you got to let the babies tell you if it's good or not.
But they can't be like, it's too salty or I don't like the taste of curry. You can only just sort of, either they're going to like frown and push the food away and cry, or they're just going to eat it like maniacs.
Yeah, we have buttons. One sound is like the Teletubby theme song and the other one is like... So they know, based off of the sound, what they don't want to hear or taste.
Seriously?
No, not seriously. But it would be amazing if that's exactly what happened. I could see it. I could see the visual.
That's your next million-dollar idea right there.
Yes.
We taped our original live show with Kwame almost a year ago, but it feels like forever ago. So much has happened since then. In the world, of course, but also with Kwame in particular. Soon after COVID hit, he helped found the Independent Restaurant Coalition and became a spokesperson for it. There are 500,000 independent restaurants in the country, and the industry as a whole employs more than 11 million Americans. The coalition was created to lobby for stimulus money to save restaurants and bars affected by the pandemic.
You know that restaurants are very different than other small businesses. The margins are very different. The workload is very different. Our inventory is very different. So we can't just turn our lights off and then turn them back on in a couple months because we get this like little package. We need real long-term help for this because we're still dealing with that to this day. And that's what we were talking about. Once we open back up at 25%, 50%, we cannot operate like that. So we need help. We need help now. We need to make some noise and we need to do whatever we can.
So Kwame, like when I saw you out in front of that effort, I was like, that's great. Like, I can see why Kwame, he seems like the kind of guy who would care about that. But it wasn't until I re-listened to your Sporkful episode a couple days ago when I was reminded that you have this long history in your family. You said your family has always had restaurants going back to your, not just your mother, but your grandmother and your great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
This is like really in your blood. What has it been like the last few months to not have that?
It's been interesting. I've had to pivot, and I'd much rather be in a room. I'd much rather touch and, you know, hug people and connect with people. You know, those, that's hospitality, you know, is that true connection of taking care of someone. So yeah, it hurts. It hurts not being in the restaurant. Even when I did go back to my restaurant, it felt strange. It felt strange putting food 6 feet away from them. It felt strange, you know, not being able to shake their hand or hug old regulars and having this extremely stripped down menu. It didn't feel right to me.
Like so many other restaurants during the pandemic, Kwame's place, Kith & Kin, closed for 3 months. They weren't even doing takeout. They reopened for outdoor dining in June. How has this affected the workers at your restaurant?
Some workers have gotten COVID, so it's affected them directly. You know, some people's family members have gotten it. Some people don't want to come back to work. Some people are afraid to come back to work. Some people are at risk, you know, health-wise, so they can't come back to work. So it's affected, you know, affected my restaurant entirely. It's devastating, and the restaurant industry as a whole.
I mean, it seemed hard to believe, but I read that 72,000 restaurants in America have closed permanently.
Yeah. I mean, they cannot sustain on 50% occupancy without help from the government. There's just no way.
The proposal that Kwame is now advocating for is a $120 billion stimulus package specifically for restaurants. The bill still needs to gain more support in Congress, which is a tall order. But Kwame and the Independent Restaurant Coalition have had some success. They were involved in pushing through amendments to the original COVID stimulus bill that benefit restaurants.
I learned that we all have a voice and we should use it. I never thought that I would be the one doing that. It's inspiring for sure, because you can also apply that to other issues. But I do think that we are a very resilient industry. We think on our feet, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we're even in this business, because we like it. You know, we love that hustle and creating great experiences for people. So I don't think it'll end, but I do think we need help in order to sustain it.
It's hard for me to imagine not wanting to go out to a restaurant and sit down in the restaurant. You know, like, yes, sometimes takeout's more convenient, especially if you got kids, but it's no substitute for the experience of going out to a restaurant.
Absolutely not. Yeah, you gotta go out, you gotta sit down and experience that. I mean, that's why people like to go out, is, you know, being taken care of.
When Kith & Kin reopened with limited capacity in early June, it was soon after the killing of George Floyd. During the protests in D.C., Kwame felt that keeping the restaurant open was his own way of showing support.
Being a restaurant that serves food of the diaspora and Black culture, it was a stopping point for people on their way to the protests. You can see them with their signs, you know, charging up with food before they went out and hit the streets. And it was a beautiful thing to see. You know, it was something that really meant a lot to me, to be able to see them getting nourishment to fight the fight and really be the representatives of our culture and what we've been through.
A month after the limited reopening, Kwame made big news in the restaurant world when he announced that he was leaving Kith & Kin. He'd been thinking about the decision for a long time, but the pandemic and the protests seemed to bring things to a head.
I was an employee there. You know, it's time for me to venture out and own my own content and start creating something that's mine.
While Kwame was the executive chef, he didn't have an ownership stake in the restaurant. It's owned by Intercontinental Hotels. When Kwame announced he was leaving, he told the New York Times, quote, "Something that profits off of Black and brown dollars should be Black owned. It's something that's very, very important to me and something that I want to achieve in the future."
I was hoping, you know, I'd be able to grow into that position. You know, I created the content, I created everything for it. And I thought that eventually down the line it would be offered in some capacity, but it wasn't. And that's okay. You know, I was an employee, and at that point, it's my decision if I want to continue to stay on or not.
So how do you feel about the fact that they wouldn't allow you to have some amount of ownership?
I mean, obviously I left, so I didn't feel great about it, but that's their decision to make. It's not my decision. So I can either stay there and continue on, or I can leave and create my own narrative. So I chose to do that. But I had a great time working with them. There's no bad blood. I would have loved to just have gotten some sort of percent of ownership and then be able to like do Kith and Kin in another city, or have that option to do that with all of that IP and heart and soul that I put into that. But you know, that's the gamble you take, you know, whenever you work for someone or when you hire someone.
I'm sure that you did not come to the decision to leave lightly. What was the hardest part about it?
Flipping the coin, you know, flipping that coin.
You mean just like the risk of starting over and going out on your own?
Yeah. I mean, that's
the unknown of it.
The unknown, you know, is like that's the biggest risk, I guess, but not really, because it's, I know what I'm able to do. I mean, I know what I'm able to create at this point in time. You know, I've opened 5 restaurants, so I've had a lot of practice, and at this point, it's just me taking matters into my own hands. So if I was able to do that with something that is in mine, I'm excited to do something that's mine, and you know, have my DNA stamped all over it.
Yeah, and there's something. I mean, I started the Sporkful 10 years ago after getting laid off from 6 radio jobs in 8 years.
Yeah.
A couple of those jobs weren't great, but a couple of them I thought, like, this is my future. I'm going to be here for 20 years. I'll work my way up. Eventually, I'll get my own show. And then, you know, whether it was poor decisions or recessions or whatever happened, and shows got canceled. So when I started this podcast, I was like, well, at least nobody can cancel it but me.
Exactly. I wanted to have control. I wanted to be able to close the restaurant when I wanted to close, whether it's for the safety of the staff, or open it when it was time to open it for various reasons. And when I looked at it and I knew I didn't have that, it was clear to me, you know, very similar to what you're saying. You know, you want to be the one to cancel. You want to be the one to shut the doors. You want to be the one to open the doors. Because at the end of the day, you have the best interest at heart for the show that you've created.
I'm confident that your next chapter will be a success.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's good timing for me to be able to take my time to really think about it, because this isn't a time for me to open a restaurant or sign a lease, you know, until we can figure this thing out. So
right.
I get some time to really think about it, think about what I want, and go from there. So I'm excited. It's an exciting moment.
I'm excited for you. I'm excited to see what's going to come next.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Is there any kind of sneak preview you can give us, or are you still contemplating?
Still contemplating, but okay. As soon as I know, you'll see it on Instagram, probably.
Okay. or we'll all get some sort of like a message zapped directly into our brains, depending on whatever technology is available at the time.
Well, by 2047, when my baby food is out, it'll be a baby restaurant, and only babies will be allowed in.
There'll be an app that will watch the babies. You won't need human nannies or parents even.
No, I mean, it seems like they're going to have full-time jobs reviewing food, so they'll be able to afford it and everything. So, I'm looking forward to it.
That's Kwame Onwuachi. His memoir is Notes from a Young Black Chef. Thank you so much for listening this week and all the weeks. I hope you enjoyed hearing these special episodes and updates as much as we enjoyed putting them together. If you liked any of our special releases this week, please share your favorite on social media. Tell your friends to check us out. We'd really appreciate it. And please make sure you stay connected to our show so you don't miss future episodes, like our next one about the enslaved man who taught Jack Daniel how to make whiskey and the 2 women who are making sure he gets the credit he deserves. So if you listen in Apple Podcasts, subscribe. And Spotify, follow. And Stitcher, favorite. Go ahead. You can do it right now while you're listening. Thanks. And one final reminder. Instagram Live 10th anniversary party is tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Bring a drink and or ice cream. I'll be bringing both, and I'll see you there. This episode was produced by Emma Morgenstern, Gofan Aputubuele, and Andres O'Hara. It was edited by Tracy Samuelson and mixed by Jared O'Connell. Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Ari Strauss from Washington, D.C., reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.